Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is a piece by a composer from Finland, Jean Sibelius, and this is his most famous work, Finlandia. It's being performed here by the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra under Herbert von Karajan. This is one of so many pieces of music written by composers who drew from unique national elements in their compositions. And on today's episode of Music for Life, we will explore how nationalism and patriotism have affected the musical output, and what makes music sound French or Italian or American. In our Sounds of Scripture segment, we will talk about the national songs of the Bible, as well as even the mention of national styles of music in the biblical record. In our Classroom Corner, we talk about the function of patriotic songs in music education. And for our backstage banter, I sit down with an ambassador of Mexican musical culture, Jesus Guzman, musical director for the Grammy Award-winning Mariachi Los Camperos. Today on Music for Life, Music for Nationalism. Just recently here at Armstrong Auditorium, the Grammy-winning export of Mexican culture, Mariachi Los Camperos, performed on our stage. As I was putting together the pre-concert talk for that program, I found I was getting an inexplicable craving for chips and salsa. The mariachi music, to that point, had been heavily associated in my mind with the cuisine of Mexican cultures. I think a similar thing would happen if I listened to some popular or folk music from other countries. I mean, what average American, after hearing a famous Italian pop song, wouldn't crave garlic bread and marinara? Say it has nothing to do with food. You hear the oompa of a German polka, and you immediately start picturing people in lederhosen. So much music of the popular and folk traditions have strong national or cultural identity. But what about in the fine art or more classical repertoire? Well, there are national styles of music here as well, and we'll explore that today. National identity in music. Now, we have had a similar episode to this one in a way, if you remember episode 12, where we explore the folk element in fine art music, and there will be some overlap, though I will try to draw from different specific examples. But it's a different subject in another sense. This is more about national identity rather than the music that borrows from a certain folk culture. A folk culture might not be associated with specific national borders. Today, we'll discuss some music that has such a strong national identity attached to it that it could even be used for patriotic purposes. Evoking the spirit of one's own nation isn't the only use of national style in fine art music. Oftentimes, composers will pay tribute to another nation, say in a stage production, to try to represent another nation musically. And how did composers do that? It wasn't always through borrowing a folk tune, as we'll see today. So let's begin our chronological, historical journey as we usually do in the time period that musicians refer to as the Baroque era. Now, I should mention that this idea of nationalism in music didn't really arise until the 19th century, the time period we refer to as the Romantic era, but there were some hints of this developing before then. In the Baroque era, which generally goes from the mid-1600s to the mid-1700s, the idea of music having a national identity was just beginning. And that stands to reason since, at this point in Western civilization, the idea of a nation-state was just now beginning itself. A nation-state is a group of people who share the same language, history, and traditions who live in a sovereign state under a single government. Prior to the 1500s, this concept of the nation-state did not largely exist in the Western world. People never identified themselves with a nation because they never left their immediate surroundings to explore the outside world, whether those surroundings were a small town or village. So even though there weren't as defined nations as we know them today, certainly the idea of national contrasts in musical style began developing in this era. Many pieces from the Baroque era actually have nationality assigned to their titles. Johann Sebastian Bach wrote 6 French suites, 6 English suites, a 3-movement solo keyboard work called the Italian Concerto, and a multi-movement suite called Overture in the French Style. These pieces didn't sound French, English, or Italian, in the sense that we would identify their sounds with those national cultures. We don't crave lasagna when we hear the Italian Concerto. And Bach, a German composer, wasn't employing any sense of patriotism toward these other cultures in writing those pieces. In fact, the terms French and English in the phrases French suite and English suite were ascribed to those suites supposedly later, not even by Bach himself. Now, Bach's Overture in a French Style, now that sounds like he might have been trying to write French-sounding music. Well, that was actually more of an homage, or maybe I should say homage, to French composers like François Couperin, a famous French composer of the time period, who had written suites like this, rather than Bach's work here being an actual homage to a French style of composing. Similarly, the Italian Concerto was a composition that Bach wrote for solo keyboard that followed the format of many concerti of that day's Italian composers. So rather than sounding like the nation of Italy, which Italy proper didn't really exist yet, it is inspired by composers of Italian heritage. Now, within those so-called French and English suites, there were dances that were named after specific folk cultures. One dance was literally called German, and another was literally Polish, the Allemande dance and Polonaise dance, respectively. And I've talked about those on previous episodes. So these French and English suites did start to allude to national identity within certain movements, it could be argued. Also in the Baroque era, composers who wrote operas, oratorios, or large instrumental suites would write an introductory movement known as an overture. Depending on the form of this piece, historians would call one style of overture French and another style Italian. For instance, the Italian overture consisted of 3 sections, fast, slow, fast, and this was a style of overture more commonly employed by Italian composers. The French overture consisted of 2 sections, a slow, stately first section based on dotted rhythms, and a fast, lively, polyphonic section. George Frideric Handel, neither French nor Italian, in his most famous composition, Messiah, employed a French-style overture at the beginning of this work. So this was more of a term that had to do with what kinds of forms each nationality was using for its overtures at the time, but didn't have as much to do with the music sounding French or Italian. Again, Handel was not French, there was no patriotic reason to write a French overture, nor would it have stirred any sense of national pride within the French hearing it. There's another Baroque example that I want to play within our next segment, so let's get into that now. This is our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. The idea of patriotic music is not just exclusive to recent history. The Bible, which largely is a historical record for a nation called Israel, contains several references to patriotic songs, national songs, and even a specific musical style that was specific to its culture. In a more general sense, the Bible calls on the entire nation to sing praises to God in verses like Zephaniah 3:14, which reads, "Sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem." Going back earlier in Israel's history, we find several references to songs sung by the entire nation, some of which were clearly intended to stir a sense of patriotism, you could say. They are clearly in praise of the nation's God. Therefore, these national hymns would have been designed to celebrate their unique deity and their unique advantages as a nation. The classic example of this is the Song of the Red Sea, or the song sung on the shores of the Red Sea, as found in Exodus 15. Alfred Sendri, in his book Music in Ancient Israel, calls it the first religious national song found in the Bible. Exodus 15:1 reads, "Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord." But notice that the entire nation sang it. They are distinguished in this verse from Moses, who is listed first as singing it. This indicates Moses' leadership role in this national hymn, and implications are that Moses would have been the composer of this hymn and then would have taught it to the nation to sing it. The point of view of this hymn's lyrics is quite personal. It says, "I will sing unto the Lord, not we will sing. And the Lord is my strength and song, not our strength and song." The song, like many national hymns of history, contains historical information highlighting this nation's triumph, or in this case, praising God for giving the nation its triumph. It says, "Pharaoh's chariots and his host has he cast into the sea. Your right hand, O Lord, has dashed in pieces the enemy." This national song even references how the song itself would be heard throughout the region. Verses 14 through 16 of Exodus 15 say this, "The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed, the mighty men of Moab. Trembling shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm they shall be as still as a stone, till your people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over which you have purchased." This song is referring to an event to happen years down the road, that is, Israel entering the Promised Land. And when it finally gets to that point, as detailed in the book of Joshua, we see that the inhabitants are quite fearful of the incoming Israelites. For instance, the famous Rahab of Jericho told the Israelite spies, "We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you," among other things she mentions. "And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts did melt because of you for the Lord your God." So certainly this song at the Red Sea would be a quintessential example of a national patriotic hymn in the biblical record, and one whose lyrics became well known to the surrounding world. The text of this song in Exodus 15 has also been the inspiration for a great deal of compositions and hymns of more recent history, most notable of which would have to be George Frideric Handel's oratorio, Israel in Egypt. The Song of Exodus 15 comprises the entire second half of this work. Part 2 opens with this anthemic homophonic chorus that uses these lyrics. "Moses and the children of Israel sang this song unto the Lord and spake, saying..." And then after that, Handel writes a complex fugue to the lyrics, "I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider has he thrown into the sea." This fugue returns again in the final movement of the oratorio, which I played in a previous episode, speaking of Miriam's part in this song. But let's listen to the first movement of part two. Here it is performed by the Monteverdi Choir, the English chamber soloists, and conductor John Elliott Gardner.
Thank you.
That was John Elliott Gardiner conducting the Monteverdi Choir and the English Chamber Soloists in the opening movement of Part 2 of Handel's oratorio, Israel in Egypt. It was a setting of the first verse of Exodus 15. The majority of that biblical chapter is devoted to the national song sung by the Israelites on the shores of the Red Sea. When we talked about this national anthem and its text a moment ago, I pointed out how this was sung by the nation, but the lyrics take on the first-person point of view when it says, "I will sing unto the Lord." Interestingly, composers of that time period would often set lyrics like that in a polyphonic way, meaning each part is doing its own thing, to emphasize the individuality of that phrase. In contrast, when the chorus sang the opening lines of the text, when you heard them sing, "Moses and the children of Israel sang this song unto the Lord and spake, saying," everyone sang the same words at the same time, what we call homophonic singing. But when it was time to sing about the individual, "I will sing unto the Lord," the composer treated the music in an individual polyphonic way. So we are talking about national songs and nationalistic musical styles as can be found in the biblical record. Slightly later in Israel's history, there's another reference to the entire nation learning and singing a song together. In this case, it was in thanks for God leading them to a well of water in the wilderness. This can be found in Numbers 21, verses 17 to 18, where it reads, according to the Revised Standard Version, "Then Israel sang this song, 'Spring up, O well, sing to it, the well which the princes dug, which the nobles of the people delved.'" So here is another song sung by the nation surrounding a historic event unique to this nation. Alfred Sendri says, "The digging of a life-giving well was an important and solemn event among the Israelites, as among Oriental nomads in general. It was accompanied by certain ceremonies and also by songs." He classifies it as a sort of national work song. Before Israel entered the Promised Land, there is one more reference to a song learned and sung by the entire nation. In Deuteronomy 31, the account there shows that God charged Moses, just before Moses' death, to write a song for everyone in the nation to learn. This was Moses' final act, in fact, as prophet to Israel. This final assignment can be found in Deuteronomy 31, 19 to 22. Basically, God said to Moses, "I know Israel will turn away after you die and once they are in the Promised Land. This is going to bring curses on them, so write this song so they are still singing it by the time they're in the Promised Land. Make it so they don't forget it, and the words will prick their consciences." Verse 30 of that chapter says, "Moses spoke in the ears of all the congregation of Israel the words of this song until they were ended." Moses made sure they'd all heard this song and learned it. The lyrics themselves are recorded in the first 43 verses of chapter 32. Then in verses 44 to 50 of Deuteronomy 32, it shows how the entire nation did, in fact, learn this song. Even Joshua, Moses' successor, helped to teach it. Later in Israel's history, we find another example of a national leader instituting a musical composition that everyone in the nation was to learn and perform, a national hymn or national anthem of sorts. Upon hearing the news that King Saul and Prince Jonathan were killed in battle, the rightful successor David composed a lamentation for these two men that he required the nation to learn and sing. 2 Samuel 1, verse 17 reads, "And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son." Then verse 18 states this, "Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher." The words "the use of" in the phrase "the use of the bow" are not in the original Hebrew, so David taught the children of Judah basically the bow, which serves as somewhat of a title for this composition. Luther's translation says that David said to teach the sons of Judah the song of the bow. The now King David wanted this lament over Saul and Jonathan to become a national anthem of sorts. Sendri says this was a song of truly antique grandeur and power. In it, David praises the powerful sword of King Saul and the mighty bow of Jonathan. The song even charges the people not to sing it outside the nation so the enemies can't gloat over these deaths. The song also contains a phrase that became quite common among English expressions, "How are the mighty fallen?" Sendri says the poem was designed to become a popular song that would preserve the glorious memory of the two heroes and at the same time serve as a national dirge. When we here at Herbert W. Armstrong College staged an original musical production on the life of King David, this song served as a pivotal moment in the second act where David's lament leads to his official ascension as Israel's king and the people's pledges of loyalty. Since the song was called the bow in the biblical record, I even used a bowed string instrument to open this lament, and the cello does a fine job setting up this mournful national anthem.
This dirge you must tell, how beauty is slain in your heights. With David lament this mournful event, your voice in this chorus unite. In Gath hold your tongue, and in Ashkelon declare not this news on its streets, lest heathen rejoice and with jubilant voice their daughters extol our defeats. How the mighty have fallen, fallen in the fray. Their weapons have vanished, and their shields are cast away.
That was just a little of The Bow from the original musical produced here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, David, the Endless Throne Begins. That was a setting of the famous text in 2 Samuel 1, David's lament over Saul and Jonathan, which became a national anthem of sorts for the people, or at the very least, an anthem specific to the tribe of Judah. So we are discussing some national songs or hymns of Israel that were unique to their nation. In terms of there being national styles of music at this time, we find evidence of this in the Bible as well. Israel's music was unique and attractive to outlying nations. We see evidence of this in a psalm. Psalm 137, which discusses the Babylonian captivity of Judah, says that they who carried us away captive required of us a song. That's in verse 3. Now, why would the Babylonian captors want to hear its Jewish captors sing? Notice what the rest of that verse reads. They that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. The songs of Zion were known to the Babylonians as different to the music they would have been used to hearing. This, no doubt, indicates Judah espoused even a different musical style to that of surrounding nations. And even the captives themselves felt conflicted about singing the music of their unique culture in a vastly different environment. As they said in verse 4, how shall we sing the eternal song in a strange land? So even back in these ancient times, national hymns, national anthems, and even unique national styles are mentioned in the biblical record. This has been Sounds of Scripture. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for Nationalism, and we are exploring how nationalism and patriotism have affected fine art music history. As we move into the classical era, a time period from about 1750 to about 1815, We see national references in specific compositions, namely the bevy of German dances written by the three major composers of this time period, Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven. We've discussed those German dances in our episode on the dance influence in fine art music. Again, this idea of nationalism, though, didn't really arise in music until the next era, the time period we refer to as the Romantic era. But we have discussed in previous episodes how Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven made use of folk elements in their works. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was writing an opera with a heavily Turkish component, so he wanted to make his opera sound like that culture in places. The opera in question was even the first opera of any consequence to be written in the German language, the significance of that being now composers would try to aim their music at their own people. In this case, it was done by what language the lyrics were in. Later on, Johannes Brahms would do something similar in writing the first major non-Latin requiem, putting it in the language of the people, also German in that case. In the Romantic era, the majority of the 19th century, the spirit of nationalism in music becomes quite prevalent. We find composers drawing on this spirit to give their music a quality that's specific to their nation. It's particularly true of the late Romantic era into the 20th century. Edvard Grieg was doing this in Norway. Jean Sibelius was doing the same in Finland, his most famous work being Finlandia, which we heard at the top of the program. Manuel de Falla, Isaac Albéniz, and Enrique Granados were at the helm of the movement in Spain. Gustav Holst and Ray Vaughan Williams were proponents of this in England. Brazil had Heitor Villa-Lobos. And we'll specifically discuss a group of Russian composers who did this as well for their country's music, as well as an Italian composer who became a symbol of national unity at a time when that nation was forming. But we also see this happening earlier in the Romantic era. A famous example of this, which we've discussed at some length already on this program, is the work of Frédéric Chopin, who drew from Polish folk dances in his piano compositions. More than just drawing on folk dance styles, Chopin's work in this area was partly about giving a musical voice or a musical identity to a nation that had historically been bullied and overshadowed by its larger, more powerful neighbors. Two specific Polish dances upon which Chopin based a slew of his piano pieces were the Polonaise and the Mazurka. I've played an example of each in a previous episode, but let's hear another mazurka. This is just an exquisite example of music that not only draws from the rhythmic qualities of this dance, it draws on even more of the unusual harmonies that give it a unique sound. It doesn't sound like generic European music. Rather, the harmonic vocabulary Chopin employs also gives us this sense of something specifically Eastern European, Slavic, or even more specifically, Polish. This is Mazurka in A minor, opus 68, number 2, performed by Artur Rubinstein. Thank you. That was pianist Artur Rubinstein performing Frédéric Chopin's Mazurka in A minor, Opus 68, No. 2. It was an example of a composition intended to both honor and sound like the Polish nation. Chopin did this by drawing on the dance rhythms of the mazurka, but also on some of the unique harmonic vocabulary specific to that area as well. As I mentioned earlier, composers didn't always employ national identity in their compositions out of patriotism for their own land. Sometimes they had a specific desire to evoke the idea of another nation in their works, so they would draw on other national elements to do this. What I mean by that is, say a composer has an opera that's set in a faraway land, so that composer might insert a musical quotation of a tune common to that faraway land. This would telegraph to the audience the impression of that land. Or say the character in that opera is far away from his homeland and sings about it for a moment, and the composer wants the audience to hear the patriotism and pride in this moment of singing. Giacomo Puccini does that exact thing in Madame Butterfly, where the Americans who are in Japan, far away from their homeland, think briefly about America. Listen to how Puccini does this. Can you pick out the American tune? So there is a portion of Madame Butterfly where the American characters think about their home country, and Puccini uses a quotation from the Star-Spangled Banner to represent America, and even the singers depart from singing in Italian, as you heard them say, "America forever," in English. Puccini did this kind of thing throughout his operas to evoke aurally the spirit of the nation where the production was set. In his opera Turandot, which takes place in China, there is much use of the Asian harmonic language to solidify the experience for the audience that we are in China. Other composers in the Romantic era would pay tribute to other nations, if not their own, through their compositions. One famous example is an Italian symphony by the early Romantic German composer Felix Mendelssohn. The 21-year-old composer was specifically trying to evoke the sights and sounds of Italy. He began work on this orchestral piece while visiting Italy for 10 months over the years 1830 to 1831. Many musicologists have offered interpretations for the Italian symphony and what scenes Mendelssohn was trying to evoke. The work's energetic and demonstrative opening movement may call to mind a lively urban scene, perhaps what you'd find in Venice, and this is the most famous movement of the symphony. The more subdued quality of the second movement might be reminiscing on Rome's former splendor, as Mendelssohn wrote that he was moved by her crumbling modern palaces and the perpetual remembrance of former splendor, causing sad and discordant sensations. The third movement is a graceful minuet. This movement may represent an elegant Florentine Renaissance palace, but this is more of conjecture. The last movement may be the most explicitly Italian, as it is based on a lively Italian dance called the Saltarello. He wrote to his sister that this symphony would be, quote, "the most sportive piece I have yet composed, especially the last movement," unquote. So let's hear this sportive, indisputably Italian final movement. That was the fourth and final movement of Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. It was an example of a composer paying homage to another nationality in his music. Mendelssohn was inspired to write this symphony on a 10-month visit to Italy. Of course, Italy as we know it today didn't really exist. This came about later in the Romantic era, and involved in that was another famous composer of history, the Italian Giuseppe Verdi, most well known for the over 24 operas he wrote. Every year in my music appreciation course here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, I read this quote from Daniel Politowski's book on music history, where he says, "Verdi was a patriot closely associated with Italy's mid-century struggle for nationhood, and his nationalism strongly influenced his work. Many of his operas have to do with revolutionary conspiracies." Verdi was a national hero, and was not only a composer, but a member of the first national parliament in 1861. His last name actually became the acronym for the movement. V-E-R-D-I stood for Vittorio Emanuele Re d'Italia, or Victor Emmanuel, King of Italy, who was the first king of a united Italy. So the letters of the composer's last name, since he was such a staunch supporter of the movement, became the acronym for the Italian unification movement. And shouts of Viva Verdi at the end of his operas were uttered both in support of the composer and the political movement. We're going to listen to an example from one of his earlier operas. Again, his operas have been interpreted as metaphoric to the struggles of the Italians against foreign oppression. And one of the most famous choruses from all his operas is the chorus of the Hebrew slaves in the opera Nabucco. Nabucco being the Italian rendition of the name Nebuchadnezzar. This chorus became virtually the anthem of the movement for Italy's national sovereignty. Here it is performed by the Slovak Philharmonic Choir and the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra with conductor Oliver Doknanyi. Oliver Dohnányi, you conducted the Slovak Philharmonic Choir and the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra in that recording of The Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Nabucco by Giuseppe Verdi. That chorus, sung by those in the opera as the ones being oppressed by Nebuchadnezzar's captivity, became an anthem of sorts for the Italian struggles for freedom and sovereignty. After the success of Nabucco, Verdi wrote 13 more operas in the next 8 years, whose plots were openly political. They stirred nationalist sentiments among Italy's revolutionaries. Over in Russia, in the mid to late 19th century, a quintet of composers wanted to establish a nationalist movement in music there. These five wanted to create a distinctly Russian sound, independent of the Western European sound that was pervasive in Russian cities at the time. The five composers formed a group known as the Russian Five or the Mighty Five, or since there are five fingers on a hand, we sometimes call them the Mighty Handful. And I can tell you at least one of them might have been considered a mighty handful all by himself. These five composers were Mili Balakirev, the leader of this group, the prolific composer Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, Modest Mussorgsky, Alexander Borodin, and Cesar Cui. They created distinctly Russian music by drawing inspiration from Russian themes, literature, and folklore. Besides great Russian composers like Mikhail Glinka and Peter Tchaikovsky, the composers in the Mighty Handful are recognized as the founders of Russian national music during the 19th century. In fact, the Mighty Five drew a great deal of inspiration from Glinka, who wrote many operas on Russian subjects. In their compositions, they tried to incorporate folk and peasant songs they heard in small Russian villages, which Glinka had referred to as the soul of Russian music, as he himself had grown up in a small Russian village. One of the members, Mussorgsky, is probably best known for his suite Pictures at an Exhibition, inspired by a series of paintings, the final movement of which is called The Great Gate of Kiev. Mussorgsky also wrote several operas, two of which have since become the pinnacle of great historical operas of this Russian tradition. These include Boris Godunov and Khovashkina, which both recount important historical events, such as the Moscow Uprising of 1682, which is covered in Khovashkina. Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, in addition to his tone poem Scheherazade, made famous by figure skaters, and his orchestral interlude Flight of the Bumblebee, his contribution to the Russian tradition also includes operas that revolve around Russian subjects, but these have more to do with Russian fairy tales and legends rather than politically charged topics. But we're going to hear an example from composer Alexander Borodin. He wrote an opera titled Prince Igor, considered a great historical opera that fits the mold of Russian nationalism. Though he never finished the work, the famous Polovshian dances from the opera are now often played as a standalone orchestral work.
Thank you.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for Nationalism, and we are exploring how nationalism and patriotism have affected fine art music history. That was another recording of the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan in an excerpt from the Polovtsian Dances in the opera Prince Igor by Alexander Borodin. This composer was part of the Russian nationalist group of composers known as the Mighty Handful. Many of the symphonies, symphonic poems, and overtures written by these five, Borodin, Rimsky-Korsakov, Mussorgsky, Cui, and Balakirev, are considered the great beginning of a purely Russian orchestral school, and the operas written among this group celebrated Russian nationalism or Russian folklore. When we come back, we will see some great examples of nationalism in music as found in the 20th century. We also will have our Classroom Corner segment and a unique backstage banter segment, complete with simultaneous translation, where we talk with the musical director for the Grammy-winning Mariachi Los Camperos, Jesus Guzman, considered an ambassador for the music of Mexican culture. We'll be right back.